Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Jarena Nadura, Tay Marie Astudio, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Terracena. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Happy New Year.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland's Folk Festival on Friday, January 10th and Saturday, January 11th, 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom in Portland. Portland's Folk Festival is an all-ages celebration of folk and Americana music in Portland. Friday performers include Anna Tivol, Cedar Teeth, Glitter Fox, and more. Saturday performers include Horse Feathers, The Get Ahead, and more. Again, that's Portland's Folk Festival, Friday, January 10th, and Saturday, January 11th, from 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
When we meet, there won't be winter.
Please, Mr. Redman, don't put me out in the street.
The Community Alliance of Tenants is working to increase awareness in Washington County of the statewide law SB 608 that was passed in early 2019. It limits rent increases and no-cause terminations for residential leases. There is a temporary bilingual English and Spanish hotline set up for Washington County renters with questions about SB 608, rent increases, no-cause termination notices, and or lease non-renewal notices. The phone number is 503-644-3007. Again, that's the Renter's Right Hotline phone number for Washington County every Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m. through January 30th at 503-644-3007. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'm right in the middle of solving that riddle known as raising the rent.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is now 8:01. Up next is Rising Up with Sonali.
From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. On our show today, we'll examine a powerful documentary on voting rights called Suppressed, The Fight to Vote by Brave New Films. Then a new book on envisioning the world we want to live in, Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined by Martin Schoenhals. That's coming up in just a moment. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. It is no secret that Republicans have worked in a concerted manner at the state level for years to make it harder for Democratic-leaning voters to cast ballots in elections. People of color and young people have been dramatically impacted by the various voter ID laws that claim to be fighting voter fraud. Except that voter fraud doesn't really exist in any significant way. And the ID laws are clearly aimed at suppressing certain people's votes. Nowhere did that play out more shockingly in recent years than in the 2018 election in Georgia, where Stacey Abrams was poised to become that state's first female African-American governor. Now a new documentary by Brave New Films explores the facets of voter suppression in Georgia and demands action to restore voting rights. My guest is Robert Greenwald, the founder and president of Brave New Films, an award-winning television feature film and documentary filmmaker. He's known for such powerful films as Outfoxed, Rupert Murdoch's War on Journalism, and Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price, Koch Brothers Exposed, Unmanned, America's Drone Wars, and Making a Killing, Guns, Greed, and the NRA. He joins me now to discuss his newest film, Suppressed, The Fight to Vote. Welcome to the program, Robert.
Thank you. Nice to be with you again.
So why was it important for you to make this film? We've seen voter ID laws and the impacts on voting rights across the country in various states at various elections. Why did you pick Georgia 2018 and specifically the race between Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams for governor?
The Georgia election is really a case study, and it's a warning cry, loud and clear, that if we don't organize, fight hard, and really work smart and intensively, we're going to see more of this voter suppression around the country. So what the film does is we dig into the personal stories. And, you know, I'm a New Yorker, I'm kind of cynical in some ways, and when I began the process, I didn't know if we would be able to find enough stories that would make a film. But as the amazing team of researchers and associate producers and producers and Casey and Laurie came to me day after day with these extensive stories, I could have done a 10-hour miniseries, the number of people whose vote was suppressed. So I put the two things together, which was we needed the personal stories, because what I like to say about Brave New Films is we put a face on policy. And we certainly had the faces here. And then make sure that we make it a case history so that people understand all the efforts and all the laws in all the states around the country that require fighting. And the fact that the film is available for free is an important point so people can use it to organize.
And we'll get to exactly how they can do that and where they can watch it a little bit later in our conversation. But let's actually watch the trailer of the documentary. Again, it's called Suppressed, The Fight to Vote, and it's just been released by Brave New Films. Here's a snippet of the film.
On my mother's dying bed at 92 years old, former sharecropper, her last words were, "Do not let them take our votes away from us."
We are witnessing a tidal wave of voter suppression around the country, and Georgia, which is becoming ground zero.
Kemp is illegally removing people from Georgia's voters list.
And my vote will not be counted.
My vote was not counted.
Old people who can't vote, there's young people who can't vote, there's people in every county who can't vote.
I'm not gonna be able to vote myself.
Target people of color, poor people, the elderly.
We're human, we have our rights to vote just like anybody else.
This is systematic. If you look at what has happened across this country, 40 states have passed some kind of law to make it more difficult for people to vote.
Look at Alabama,
Arkansas,
North Carolina,
Ohio,
Kansas,
North Dakota,
Michigan,
Wisconsin,
and Georgia, which is becoming ground zero.
We are not going to let them take from us what our grandparents and parents fought and suffered and died to give us in the first place.
We are here to resist an ID law that is undemocratic, unconstitutional, and immoral.
Her last words were, "Do not let them take our votes away from us."
And that's the trailer for the brand new documentary film, Suppressed, The Fight to Vote. And we'll tell you shortly where you can watch the film, how you can organize screening parties, and most importantly, what action you can actually take. Robert Greenwald is with me, the founder and president of Brave New Films, which actually released the documentary. Robert, how important was it to put this, what happened in Georgia, into a historical framework of, in particular, the Black-led fight to have the right to vote?
The historical framework and the continuing efforts were really important because it's not something that started yesterday. What is new, and we talk about it in the film, is it's not one person. It's not the Ku Klux Klan coming at night. It's not pure physical terrorism. But it's 5, 6, 7, 8 different ways that voter suppression is being implemented, was implemented in Georgia. And so what the film does is historical, but it really tells you today all the different ways, from moving polling places to voter ID, which you mentioned, to names that are hyphenated and therefore have a disproportionate number of African Americans who are disqualified, literally not being able to vote because a dash between their names is on the driver's license but is not on their Social Security. And as one of the folks says, it's about resource allocation. We have people in white districts who say, oh, yeah, it was very pleasant, I came in. And then we have people who are voting in heavily Democratic and African-American districts who tell us stories about waiting an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, and 6 hours to vote. I don't know about you, but I get impatient when it's 5 minutes. And I can't imagine the level of humiliation and anger at being forced to wait that long for what is a fundamental right of our country and a democracy.
Right. I mean, it's not like we get a day off to vote here in this country. It's not like there's any kind of financial incentive. In fact, you generally pay a financial price if you're a working person and maybe you work hourly. It's inconvenient. People do it because they want to have democratic participation in their government. So let's watch another clip from the film, referring specifically to what you were just saying about the long lines in districts that are primarily of people of color.
We have seen long lines.
Long lines still there. Wow.
We've got the research that shows that African Americans and Latinos who live in African American and Hispanic neighborhoods wait the longest in line to vote.
Some were here for 3 hours.
Here for 3 hours.
Others here for much longer.
4 or 5 hour wait.
5 hours.
It never died down.
This is way, way too long for us to stay and vote.
Whites who live in white neighborhoods wait the least amount of time in line to vote.
It was really good. The lines weren't too long and everyone was super helpful.
We don't hardly ever have to wait here. It's always a pleasant experience up here.
How that happens is resource allocation.
Make that resource unavailable to the people who you don't want to vote. And that's exactly what happened in the 2018 election here in the state of Georgia. In black neighborhoods, there were a quarter of the number of machines that were needed to service the population.
Everyone in the world knew we were going to vote today. All these dedicated people waiting to vote. This is what we call voter suppression.
And that's a clip from the documentary Suppressed the Fight to Vote. With me still is Robert Greenwald, founder and president of Brave New Films. So, Robert, how can people watch the film? You said it's freely available online. And what exactly are you asking for people to do? Not as an, you know, of course they can watch it individually, but you want them to actually take action in groups of people, right?
Exactly. So the film is available for free at Brave New Films. You can go to the website. And then we offer a series of tools to help you with screenings. Try to do it at a school, at a place of worship, at libraries around the country, bookstores, homes, political leaders, advocacy groups. Indivisible, I think I just heard, they've got 20 or 30 screenings. Fair Fight has had over 100 screenings. And the point is, when you come together in a group and you watch a film, It increases the possibility, it increases the motivation, it increases the focus about taking action. Now, we never have decided, going back to Outfoxed or Walmart or any of the films, we've never decided here's the one thing you should do. But what we do is we offer on the website all of the groups who have worked with Ann over this last year to provide information, to give us leads about who to cast, and to go to those groups depending on who you think will be the most effective and what your skill set is. So do you want to do local organizing? Do you want to do electoral work? Do you want to do ballot initiatives? I mean, there's so many different things that people can do. The key role that the film plays, we hope, is to connect the emotion and the thought process, to have people stirred up, to have people upset and angry, and then people doing something. And if they just watch the film and don't do anything, we've failed. But so far, the indications have been very strong from around the country. As already there are hundreds of screenings, and our goal, it's ambitious, but it's 2020 by 2020, meaning 2020 screenings before the 2020 elections.
I want to play one more clip from the film that covers another aspect of the suppression that took place specifically in Georgia, which was that thousands, and actually tens of thousands of people, never received their mail-in ballots. Here is Peggy's story.
My name is Peggy Hsu. I'm from Johns Creek, Georgia. I mailed out my absentee ballot application so that our registrar would send an absentee ballot. I checked my mailbox every day. It was like nearing the end of the month. And so I started calling the voter protection hotline. I called my registrar. I sent emails, and it was really, really getting close to the election date. And I never received my ballot. The election day came and went, and I wasn't able to vote in the end.
And that is Peggy, who is one of the many people in Georgia who is featured in the documentary Suppressed: The Fight to Vote, who never received her absentee ballot. Robert, your film points out that there were some 40,000 people in Georgia who didn't receive their ballots, and Kemp won the race against Stacey Abrams by about 50,000 something votes. So on the same order. That's shocking.
Yes, the statistics which we weave into the film really are very, very clear that if you take all of the different efforts around suppressing, again, in many different ways, purging. Kemp purged an incredible number of people from the ballot in the last year or so. Then you look at the polling places that they closed, and you tell the story very clearly that if you move polling places, people who have low income, don't have vehicles, have jobs that they can't miss, are elderly, those people are being penalized. And over and over and over again, it was done in districts. So remember, it's not that they're choosing individual people and saying, we're not going to let you vote. They are smarter than that. They're identifying districts that tend to be heavily African-American, heavily student, heavily Democratic, and therefore in those districts, putting the greatest efforts into taking away polling places, purging people, and using all of the semi-legal resources to make it difficult for people to vote.
And just a reminder, Brian Kemp, I mean, the reason why he was able to do all of this was because while he was running for governor, he was the Secretary of State of Georgia, which is precisely the position of power when it comes to the issue of voting rights. Now, a lot of this was unleashed by the Supreme Court's decision some years ago to strike down a critical part of the 1964 Voting Rights Act, right, Robert? Really shocking, because it was premised on this idea that we no longer have racism in America and race-based voter suppression in America, which of course we know to be completely untrue. So in order to beat back these attacks on people's right to vote, are you hoping that your film inspires state-level activism or federal-level activism, or both?
all of the above, and city-level activism and community-level activism. I personally am a big believer in activism, and it can manifest itself in many different ways. But the first step is knowing, is being informed, is being aroused, is seeing right in front of us, here is systemic abuse. This is not an individual machine failing. This is not one corrupt politician. This is system-wide, and it's system-wide in Georgia. It's going to spread to other states. Now, the good news is there are people who are fighting the fights in different states. Some we've won on the side of fairness and democracy and patriotism, and some we've lost to the corruption of politicians who literally want to choose who the voters are, rather than the voters choosing the politician. Right. So it's not an immediate, quick victory or defeat. It's going to be longer term. But if we don't start now, we're going to be paying a price in the 2020 elections, and none of us want that.
Tell me in particular about the stories in your documentary from African-American seniors who remember the blood lost and that was shed in winning the fight for African Americans to vote decades ago, and who have now seen the rollback of that incredibly important battle that we thought was won.
Yes, well, that's the, on some levels, the tragic part of this. The fact that we have to have a discussion today, this year, about people's right to vote is both disgusting and horrific and demands our attention. So in the film, one of the most powerful stories, and there are many, are Mr. Brooks, who's 89 years old, who says he's voted in every election, was a veteran of the war, and they were trying to close his polling place. He would not be able to vote had they moved and closed his polling place. Dr. Carol Anderson talks about that. She says the data is very clear. For each, I think it's each mile or 2 miles, you force somebody to go in order to vote, there's a drop off in voting percentage. There's a veteran who says very clearly, listen to this, it was easier to vote absentee when he was in Iraq than it was to vote absentee when he was one state over from Georgia. I mean, that's what we all are dealing with, and that's why I hope it will be a call to action, a call to arms, and many people who've seen other films and who haven't will see this one, will be motivated to say, yes, I can do something. Yes, I will do something. This is what patriotism and democracy really is about.
And, it's not just, of course, the gubernatorial race in Georgia. We have a nationwide effort in various states. And also we have our own president right now who made the outrageous claim that the reason why he lost the popular vote in 2016 was because there were these millions of illegals voting, quote unquote, undocumented immigrants in his mind voting for Hillary Clinton, which is why he says he lost the popular vote, which is, of course, part of his white supremacist agenda. And you can't just, of course, blame Trump, right? The white supremacist agenda of the Republican Party has been couched in suppressing the vote of people of color. What else can you call it if you're systematically suppressing the voting power of people of color? It's based on the premise that whites are superior.
Yes, and that black people and people of color and students should not be able to vote. We even have a clip in the film of a Republican basically saying that if all of these people vote, then we're going to be in trouble in terms of keeping our jobs. So again, it's very important fundamentally, rather than these elected officials and their supporters working to reach the voters, what they're working to do is stop people from voting. And, we've seen that. We've seen it with poll taxes. We've seen it with terrorism for years ago. I never expected that we'd be fighting this fight again today, but we are, and we can't hide from it. It's a critically important. All the efforts that gone into registering people to vote and getting out the vote, critical, important, millions and millions of dollars. But if those people are not allowed to vote, then those efforts are going to be for nothing.
So we have just about a year before the next election. You said you're hoping to have 2020 screenings of the documentary by 2020 of and the 2020 election. Specifically, what can be done in this year? So say someone, you know, next week organizes a house party, watches the film, they get a copy of the discussion guide, which lays out some very specific actions they can take ahead of the next election.
There'll be the discussion guide. There's a guide for those who watch in places of faith orientation called reflection guides. And they primarily encourage people to think about the different options. Again, then if you go to the website, depending where your interest is, you can find multiple groups that you can decide to get involved with and decide how to get involved. Is it as a volunteer? Is it making phone calls? Is it working for some of the national legislation? Is it working for the state legislation? The variety really is infinite, so there's no reason that every single person can't do something. And it can start by signing up, doing a screening. Bring three people together in your home. Bring 10 people together at your workplace and show it on your phone during lunch. Bring 20 people together at the bowling alley and have it on your phone. There are so many ways today where the technology is actually ahead of where we are. But this film was made to be shown in all those possible places so that it can have a real impact. And also so that at the end of the day, come 2020, I don't think anybody wants to wake up in the morning after the election and think they didn't do every possible thing they're capable of doing.
Right. The film, again, available at fighttovote.com. And as you suggested, people can actually watch it on their phone. It's not very long. You can watch it in your lunch hour because it's 38 minutes long. So just long enough to hold the attention of a group of people and still have time left over for a discussion. Robert, you're known for making very, very useful tools for activists, and it certainly looks like this is one of them. The website where you can watch the film is fighttovote.com, or you can also get it through Brave New Films' website. So fighttovote.com. We'll link to that and also embed the documentary on our website. Robert, thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thank you for all your help and for spreading the word, and thanks to all of the audience. Counting on you, as always, to get involved, take action, and make change.
My guest has been Robert Greenwald, founder and president of Brave New Films, award-winning television, feature film, and documentary filmmaker. We've been discussing his latest film, Suppressed, The Fight to Vote. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Progressives can clearly articulate what we're fighting against. Poverty and racism, sexism and homophobia, wars, climate change, injustice in general. But what are we fighting for? In the 1990s and 2000s, the slogan, "Another world is possible," took hold. But today we seem further than ever from the ideal society we want. Now a new book is applying scientific and historical research to help answer the question of the kind of world we want to live in and how we can achieve it. The book has been written by my guest, Martin Shainhalls, an anthropologist on the faculty of Appalachian State University. He's previously taught at Columbia University, Johns Hopkins, and the University of Pennsylvania. His earlier books include The Paradox of Power and Intimate Exclusion. He joins me to discuss his newest book, Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. Welcome to the program, Martin.
Thank you, Sonali.
So first, let's talk about what exactly has driven you to write a book like this. The word utopia, unfortunately, is often used by the so-called pragmatists to dismiss those of us who are fighting for a better world, right?
It is. And I use the word quite intentionally, precisely for that reason, because I want to reclaim the word and the feelings that go along with it to say that not only can we critique the world as it is, but that we should offer bold alternatives and that there is, in fact, an alternative that's possible.
So those who subscribe to this idea that Darwinist, thoughts on evolution and Darwinist ideology on evolution can be applied to human societies today, you know, survival of the fittest, will justify how things work, will justify the hierarchies that we live in, will justify the fact that there seems to always be an underclass of oppressed as those who are the haves fight against the have-nots. But is that inevitable? And these are big questions, of course, that people who are like evolutionary biologists have tried to answer in the past. Is hierarchy, is a power difference and that unjust power dynamic between classes of humans inevitable because it's our nature?
Not at all. It is not only not inevitable, but when humans first appeared on Earth about 200,000 years ago in Africa, up until about 6,000 years ago, we lived as foraging people, which means that we got our food by hunting and gathering. We lived in small groups, we were very cooperative, and we lived with very little hierarchy. And this is not just a fantasy, this is a reality that has been documented carefully by anthropologists. And so what that means is that for 95% of humans' time on Earth, we have lived an egalitarian way of life. It happened in the past, and that shows that we have that capacity within ourselves currently.
Let's dig a little bit into those details, because you're right. It's something that has been written about, and sometimes the details have been glossed over. What sort of an egalitarian society has humanity existed in for 95% of its existence? Are we talking about egalitarianism that includes women? Are we talking about egalitarianism that includes, animals or nature?
So the answer is that, for example, on the issue of gender, most anthropologists consider that foraging people are the most egalitarian of all peoples, even more so than the most egalitarian societies that we might find in the contemporary world. And one of the important things about foraging peoples is that they had no concept of land ownership and no concept of real ownership in the way that we have it. And that's really important because that meant that there were no differences in terms of ownership of wealth. Also, one of the really important things to know is that as far as leaders go, the ideal leader had to be a humble person who would persuade others to follow him or her, and there were also female leaders, and they had to persuade rather than coerce. Anyone who was coercive or in any way arrogant, that person would face extreme ostracism and shaming from the group. You know, one of the things that is most looked down upon in small-scale foraging societies, but also even in small-scale agricultural societies, like one of the ones in rural China that I studied, what's most looked down upon is the person who's arrogant and who's not generous. And so this is the reality of humans and our capacity and our desire to live as egalitarians.
So let's talk about that research that you did in China that I understand was in part the basis of an earlier book that you wrote. What was that research and how did it inform the book that you have just released, Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia?
So I am referring to my work among the Yi people. The Yi are an ethnic minority group in China who live in the high mountains. They're subsistence agriculturalists. And they have a kind of informal leader who is not voted on or otherwise selected, but kind of informally looked up to. And the things that that person most needed would be a kind of temperament that was very generous, very giving, and very fair, because those leaders, their prime responsibility was to share with other people and also to negotiate ends to conflict. And this is something that holds not only among the Yi people, but among many, many small-scale societies studied by anthropologists. It's only really with the rise of what are called civilizations, but we as anthropologists hesitate to call them civilizations, but the civilizations we're all familiar with. It's only at that time that you get hierarchy, and even then there are various kinds of checks on the hierarchy.
So what was it about these quote-unquote civilizations that created that turning point in human history where we find ourselves in this, you know, deeply unequal society, unjust society? Are we talking about the advent of weaponry or industrial agriculture or capitalism or slavery or all of the above?
Just about all of the above. So what this is, the origins of hierarchy are debated and theorized by anthropologists, and it's not known for sure how it all came about, because 6,000 years ago there was no written history documenting how hierarchy was happening. But what one of the most popular theories, and one that I'm convinced has a lot of reason to it, is that there started to be with property, with agriculture, there started to be property, and with property, people in certain regions, usually the prosperous ones, the river valleys like in Mesopotamia or the Nile, certain groups started to raid other groups either for animals or for land. And warfare led to conquest, and conquest led to slavery. And so most anthropologists believe that the very first hierarchy was due to the enslaving of conquered peoples. And that had all kinds of repercussions as well for women, because male warrior groups were formed that based themselves around a kind of notion of the kinship of the male group and the outsiderness of women.
So before we get to actually envisioning that utopian society, I want to address this question of human nature. I mean, if you're suggesting that for 95% of our existence, we didn't give in to our baser nature, then maybe I've already answered my question. But there are many who would suggest, you know, in the vein of Ayn Rand's work, that we are inherently selfish people, that we are inherently, that we are our best when we act in our own selfishness. Is there any truth or any scientific basis for some of those claims?
No, not really. I mean, obviously humans can be very hierarchical. under certain circumstances, and that's my reason for writing the book, is that under the right circumstances, the kind of better part of our capacities, the egalitarian nature, the sharing nature, can come to the fore. But we survived, humans, from 200,000 years ago through to 10,000 years ago in a very harsh environment and with very difficult circumstances. And one of the things that made us survive was the fact that we shared within the group. Had we not done that, had we not been helpful to each other, humans as a species most likely would not have survived. So our nature, as it has been documented by anthropologists, is not an Ayn Rand human nature, but a very different one. And it's only within the last 5% of human history that we have acted with slavery and with hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And so that distorts the way that we think about human nature.
But isn't the genie out of the bottle now? I mean, can we not, can we really put it back the way it was? Ought we to even think of it in those terms when we want to undo the damage of, you know, the last several centuries and return to that idealistic society, or at least more egalitarian society? Are we talking about going backward or forward?
We are not talking about going backward, and I realize it's a very good question. It's one that my students often ask me. They will all say, do you think that we want to return to a forager time, because they like their cell phones and other things like that, and I'm not advocating that. In fact, one of the things that's very true about humans is that we're very flexible. And even in the worst circumstances of human society that we see in the 20th century and the 21st century, there are all kinds of people doing really often unnoticed, very compassionate sorts of things. And so I'm not being Pollyanna-ish. I'm not denying by any means the horribleness of the 20th century and continuing into the 21st century. All kinds of awful things that humans have done to each other. But what I'm saying is there are reasons that we act that way. And if those social formations are changed, we can act in a very different way.
So let's talk about how we envision work, because that's part of your the first part of your subtitle, Work, Love, and Learning. So work is the topic of so much discussion these days, especially in the United States. Workers are striking. Many who are caught up in the gig economy are struggling, and yet we're told unemployment is at its lowest rates ever. So what are we complaining about? This idea of work, what role it plays in our lives, and what we deserve, what our rights are when we think about work, are big questions. How should we envision the role of work in our utopian society?
Well, I think that for starters, the fact that work is so much a part of our lives and our identities, it's always really, really puzzled me why people don't talk about the ways to make work more enjoyable and to make it enjoyable in a kind of voluntaristic sense. And so one of the things that is central to my utopia, although it's by no means the only element, but it's an important element, is to guarantee the basics of subsistence to all people so that no one has to work, so that we work because we want to do so, not because we're made to do so by someone with greater authority than us. And I think that's that issue of kind of distribution of subsistence to all people and a changing way of thinking about work is something that we rapidly are going to have to face. You know, in the 20th century, so many people were farmers up until the 1920s, I think, in the United States, about half of all people were farmers. And as agricultural efficiency increased, the number of people who could be employed as farmers plummeted. And the same thing, of course, has happened with industry. I grew up in the Detroit area, and so I've seen that very much, that with the automation of much of the auto industry, large numbers of people have been put out of work. It's true that the official unemployment rate is now low, but as I'm sure many of your listeners will know, the unemployment rate that usually that's quoted does not include those who have given up looking for work because they're discouraged, and other. It doesn't consider whether people are earning enough money in a particular work. And so I'm sure you know, as I know, so many people who are working in the gig economy, not because they want to, but because they can't get other work. They're not earning enough. They're not earning enough at a job that is consonant with their abilities and their desires. Mm-hmm. And so there's something strange about that as the world gets more efficient, theoretically, that we accept or seem to accept the idea that we all have to live with less and less money and less salary unless we're at the very top. There's no reason that has to be true.
So in our utopian world, do you envision what people are talking about now more and more openly, this idea of a universal basic income, for example?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And I'm so pleased to see the Democratic candidates talking about a basic income guarantee. Some of them are talking about various kinds of full employment bills or full employment guarantees. These are things that we haven't talked about in the United States, at least, since the 1970s. And I don't know why we haven't talked about them, because anyone looking around at what's happening, for example, the origins or the coming of autonomous driving vehicles, there are several million people who make a living driving vehicles, and they in short order will be put out of work. And of course, that doesn't have to be a bad thing. And what I'm arguing is it's precisely a good thing. If the drudge labor that most of us don't want to do doesn't exist, That's a virtue, and that's something that we should take advantage of by using that time that all of us will then have for creative exploits. For
me, as long as our needs are taken care of. Right.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so, you know, I know that there are lots of people who will say that the idea of giving basic subsistence needs to people who don't work will encourage laziness or all kinds of things. But, you know, it used to be the case that children worked, and we now accept the idea that children should not work, and yet we don't divorce them from subsistence needs because they don't work. We fully accept the idea that children should be housed and fed, although, of course, the United States doesn't do a good job with all children doing that. But the notion, nonetheless, that work and subsistence necessarily have to be linked is an artificial one, and one that hasn't even existed at all times in history and certainly won't exist in the near future.
And we know in our society today that those who want to engage in creative work are only able to if they're already privileged. The worlds of creativity and art are often dominated by the independently wealthy because they don't have to worry about earning a living, whereas those who struggle to make it into those creative fields are, you know, that the idea of the starving artist is very much real. It's becoming more and more true now of academics as well. Are adjunct, so-called adjunct faculty in universities around the country are often being paid poverty-level wages. And so, you know, certainly there is a great desire, right, among humans to engage in creative work if we only had the means to do so. And it could create a much richer society for us.
Yes, exactly. There is absolutely no reason why we couldn't have a society in which that's the case. I document clearly and carefully in the book that the world is capable of producing more than enough food. There are all kinds of inefficiencies in, for example, food waste. And so I carefully document the idea that scarcity does not have to be the condition under which we all live. And in fact, there's no reason that the starving artists and the now starving academics that you refer to need to starve. We can and should give the basics of a reasonable life to all people. That's not a strange idea, of course, even as far as adults. It's in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which Eleanor Roosevelt was very instrumental in writing. And so I'm calling upon us doing that, and in so doing, to allow that person who is a starving artist to not only eat, but also to be able to have the time to create. And then the other thing is to have an audience to appreciate his or her creations. I think a really good economy is one that provides an audience, and I'm using audience in a kind of metaphoric way, for all of our creations. I'm sure you know, as I do, so many people who spend so much time working on art and doing so many things and not getting any recognition for it. And that's a real tragedy and a real waste and human happiness. And there's no reason for that to happen.
Let's talk about the learning part of the book that you write about. There's so much discussion about here in the U.S., especially about how our educational system is broken in terms of the kinds of values that kids learn, but how they're taught as well. And then when they do graduate, how they're able to live or go to access higher education and then choose between going to debt versus not. Our system of learning is clearly broken as well. How could it look if we were to put our minds to it?
So just as with work, I want to inject a discussion of the pleasure and the joy into the way that we think about work. I want to do the same with learning. It's always really shocked me that in all of the discussions about learning, very, very rarely are the pleasures of learning discussed. Or if they're discussed, they're discussed as something that's still instrumental, something that will make kids want to learn more. But ultimately, the goal of learning is always said to be for national glory and individual prosperity. And I think that's a real tragedy too, because I see so often, having taught many different ages of students, the kind of anxiety that puts students under. And it's an anxiety that is unnatural. Kids, when we're very young, we all love to learn. It's the human legacy, the desire to learn and the joy in learning. And school somehow has a way of almost always crushing that desire because it's coerced, because it's instrumental, and because the joys and the pleasures of learning aren't recognized. So I want to return school to a kind of situation that's more like the way that we are when we're young. You know, learning our mother tongue is one of the most difficult feats cognitively, and it's something that we learn not because someone is dangling grades or money or anything else in front of us. It's something that we learn as kids kind of automatically because of the joys of wanting to communicate, and we do it within a social context. And for me, that's a good model for how learning should be.
And then there's love. You know, love is something that's considered deeply personal. Unfortunately, our government has gotten involved, particularly when it comes to the rights of same-sex couples to love one another. How do we, and of course, love is what also inherently makes us human, our ability to love. Although, you know, of course, we may not know how animals love one another or what love even means outside of the human realm, but certainly it seems to be something that makes us uniquely human. What can love look like in a utopian society?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because so often people who are progressive, we talk about either the economy or we talk about relationships and gender and love, but we don't talk about both. And I think that we need to talk about both, about all of them, work, love, and learning. And love should be as egalitarian as work. And I think that there is no reason that we can't seek a society in which there's equality of love and attention to all people in many of the same ways that we would seek equality of wealth. And what I envision by that is that there will be a media that will be devoted to portraying the stories of average people. You know, right now, the media usually obsesses on celebrities. There's a cult of the celebrity, and everyone else gets ignored. And so what I envision is a media that would specifically do the life histories and the stories of average people. This is something that anthropologists do anyway, and so it's kind of a professional point of pride on my part to say that we should have a media that does this, to tell the stories of remote people, of people who are neglected, and by doing that, to give attention to those people who often don't get it. And by doing that, I'm seeking to kind of challenge the hierarchy that exists in the world of love and romance, the hierarchy that says that there are only certain people worthy of attention, certain people who are worthy of being considered attractive. That needs to be challenged.
So the all-important question, which we should certainly discuss, is how do we get there, right? Because it's one thing to envision it, even if it's something that we say is possible, but to actually get there, doesn't that require sustained and dedicated grassroots efforts and activism to demand that not only are all of these utopian ideals possible, but that we deserve them and that we ought to have them now?
Yes, exactly. Well, that is a very challenging question you ask, but one very important part to me of getting there is for us to talk about the alternatives and to reject the Thatcher's notion that there is no alternative. There is, in fact, an alternative, and one that can be very pragmatic as well as idealistic, as I describe in the book. So what I'm hoping with the book is to get people to discuss, and to discuss in groups, to discuss how things could be different, to start to imagine a different kind of society, a different way of thinking about work, a different way of thinking about learning and love, and in so doing, to start to change from that kind of apathetic and despairing feeling that we can't change anything, that nothing will change, to a feeling of hope and possibility.
We haven't talked about climate and climate change, and I'm wondering if you've written about this, because, you know, all of these technological advances that we do enjoy today that do result in transportation and technology and us being able to have cell phones and access to information are also things that are unfortunately killing our atmosphere and potentially threatening our own human existence. Is a utopian ideal that you write about in your book consistent with a world where we don't have an unstable climate?
Yes, it's perfectly consistent with I know that all of your listeners will easily know that there's so much money and kind of a corruption of what the U.S. should be doing by the fossil fuel industry. And in a society that has egalitarian distribution of wealth and no money and a kind of collective ownership of natural resources, that will help to provide an impetus to change to other sources of energy. You know, the technologies are there and they're constantly being improved upon, and that's a piece of what I would advocate as well for utopia. A very important piece is that kind of care of animals and care of the natural resources be part of that utopia. And so if the hierarchical piece and the ownership piece changes, then we can act in ways that are much more sensible.
I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Martin, good luck with your book.
Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest has been Martin Shane Halls, anthropologist on the faculty of Appalachian State University. He previously taught at Columbia University, Johns Hopkins, and UPenn. His earlier books include The Paradox of Power and Intimate Exclusion. And we've been talking about his newest book called Work, Love, and Learning in Utopia, Equality Reimagined. I'm Sonali Kohatka. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do subscribe to our audio podcast on iTunes and our video channel on Vimeo.
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatka. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on facebook.com/RU with Sonali. That's the letters RU with Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RU with Sonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files. Oh, make me over. I'm all I want to be. A walking study.
Good morning, Portland. So glad that you can make it to the new year with us here at KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and in Hood River, K220HR 91.9 FM. The time is 9 a.m. And again, this is KBOO. Welcome to 2020.
Join us on Tuesday, January 21st for Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years, a day of special programming looking back